Hey yo, what's up world? This is DJ JS1 of the legendary Rocksteady Crew. And right now, you're listening to The Library with my man, Tim Einenkel, Strictly the Real Hip Hop. Peace.
Therapeutic to the user, not fixed. Slam dance to it, my drug music. Therapeutic to the user, not fixed. Slam dance to it, yawn valley of the dolls, married to the Mars, fuck carried at the prom.
My next guest is a DJ, a member of the Rocksteady Crew, a manager, has run record labels, a radio host. He seems to know most, if not all, aspects of the music industry. Currently is the host of Rap is Out of Control on Sirius XM and manages acts like Heavy Metal Kings, La Coca Notra, Ill Bill, and many more. He's DJ Eclipse, and I want to welcome him to the Library with Tim Einenkel. Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
Drugs and drinks, bloods and crips, coke dealers, thugs and pimps. Under the influence of things, I bring the drug musical, shooting you up with dope, beautifully composed, narcotic and diabolical. You're like a crackhead prostitute without the loot, but it's the music that's responsible. My drug music, therapeutic to the user, not fixed. Slam dance to it, my drug music.
All right, so obviously from the beginning, why did you get involved with hip-hop music, and then what kind of drew you to it, and then what do you want it to serve for you, and what do you want to serve for it?
Initially, it was hearing the music and having it captivate me. You know, the first record I heard was Rap is Delight, and I heard it at a school party. I was in the fifth grade, and one of the kids in class brought it into the party and played it, and I had never heard that before. You know, prior to that, I was totally like Casey Kasem, top 40, listening to Hall & Oates and, you know, whatever else came on the radio. And so when that came on, it was just like, wow, like this is crazy. Like this is totally different. And this is something that it just, I don't know, something about it clicked with me. And enough that I actually wanted to own the record, you know. So that was, you know, the first hip hop record I bought. That was the first record really I bought outside of like records that were kind of handed down to me. So it just is something about the music that spoke to me, and I knew it was something special. And so you wanted to know more about the music. And so you just start kind of investigating and finding, you know, trying to find out stations on the ground, college stations that would play, you know, the same type of music. And so you just find out what else is out there. And so it just became part of what I would do, you know, which was find the music. And then along with the music comes the culture, you know, which is the, you know, the break-in and the MCing and DJing and the graph. And so it was just like it was a movement, and it felt like a movement. And so it just took me over where it was just like at the age of, you know, 14, I decided that I actually wanted to start DJing. So prior to that, I was actually buying records just to kind of collect them, you know, the same way you would collect comic books or whatever. It's like, I just bought the records and they'd be in my collection. And it wasn't until I was 14 where I was like, all right, you know, I tried my hand at like all the elements of hip hop. And I was like, DJing really seems the most special to me. And I kind of just would watch some of the people in my neighborhood that were older than me that were doing stuff. And I kind of like, you know, studied them and picked up some notes from them. And then that was why I became a DJ. And then as far as just like the initial process of getting into hip hop is more of like, you just kind of, you're experiencing it. You're in the middle of it. You're doing it. And then once you do it long enough, it's like, okay, let me now contribute to it. You know, let me now be an artist. Let me now try to make records like the ones I'm hearing. And then it went from that step to then, you know, paying your dues, walking up the ladder, you know, step by step, getting another notch to the point where my life now is based on kind of like upholding hip hop culture, you know, and making sure that as far as I'm concerned, that it's done right as far as what I can actually put my hands on, you know. So that's my duty here.
You mentioned that you tried the other elements. Mm-hmm. Do you remember the first element you tried besides DJing? That you thought maybe...
I mean, everything was kind of, you know, at the same time. It was all... DJing was probably the last thing just because I didn't have the equipment, you know. So it was... I never really tried to rap, but I would write rhymes. Right. I would just sit there and write rhymes. But graffiti and breaking were definitely like the first two elements that I kind of like would do. And I sucked at graph. So, I mean, I kind of gave that up. But breaking was, you know, I mean, everyone, we all, you know, all the kids in my hood were breaking, so we were all just breaking. And then, you know, we you go to school and you see other kids that are like from different neighborhoods, and like you kind of peep people out and who's good, who's not. And so breaking was a big thing for us. That was probably like, you know, what we did the most. And then it just became a point where I had the records and it was like, you know what, like I'm going to start saving up to be a DJ. And so that became the final element for me and the one I stuck with.
What was your, I just care, at the age of 14, what was the, I mean, you were in Rhode Island, so like, yes. What was the, I guess, the support system in terms of kind of nurturing your art?
Sure.
Was it your teachers? Was it your parents? Was it just fellow kids in the, you know, in the community?
It was community. It was as far as like my, where I lived in my neighborhood, I was kind of like the person to bring the music to everyone else. You know, everyone kind of like would look to me to find out what was new. I'd be at the record store every week buying stuff. But as far as who was influencing me and supporting me was the kids that were, I was finding on the radio or in school. You know, there was these kids, Magical Four, that were local that I didn't realize were actually local at the time because they were playing their music on the radio on the college shows. And so, you know, there was a couple of different college shows, RIU, BRU, URI. So there was DOM. There's a few different shows that would play the music. So you listen to the music at night, and then again, like, you catch the names, you know. And so, like, you know, this kid, Buck, DJ Bucket, you know, he was one of the guest DJs every once in a while, and he would always like cut and scratch. And then I found out that Bucket was the DJ for the group Magical Four. So that right there was just like, oh wait, so Bucket's from here, then that must mean that they're from here. And sure enough, I ended up going to school when I got older with three of them, you know, went to the same school as me. And so I became semi cool with them, more so with some of their cousins. And I'd hang out with them, and then we'd go over to their house, and I'd just watch what they did. You know, I'd go to shows. They would perform. They'd open up for, like, if Grandmaster Flash came to town or if Dougie Fresh came to town, they'd be the group to open up for them. So I'd watch them perform. I'd watch the DJ Bucket get busy at, like, USA Skating Rink or the Living Room or, like, wherever he played, I'd watch, and I would just study. And so that really was what made me want to do it, was just, like, watching what they did. And then I just, you know, I had a paper route. I ended up getting two paper routes because I took over someone else's. And I would just spend all my money on music. And then I just decided I was going to save it to buy equipment. Between Christmas, birthdays, and the money I made from the paper route, I just went ahead and started buying equipment. And so once I had like a full setup, I was officially a DJ at that point.
So how did you get to, from DJing to Wild Pitch Records?
DJing, I had my first setup when I was in Rhode Island, but then shortly after I got that, I probably had my full setup at the beginning of 85. By the end of 85, I was moving down south. So I went down to South Carolina the whole time from 85 until 92 while I was in South Carolina is when I actually kind of made my name as a DJ. So I took whatever knowledge I had from up north, moved down south, put it to work, and then started DJing whatever spots I could do, clubs, you know, this, that, did some radio, all that stuff. So made my name down there, and then that led me to working at a record store. Working at the record store, I actually started meeting some of the artists that would come through on, like, promotional retail runs. I met MC Search from Third Base there, and he actually was just getting ready to release his solo album, Return of the Product. And a friend of mine who I had met in South Carolina, T-Ray, Todd Ray, had produced half of Search's album that had yet to come out. But Todd had already sent me it, so I knew what all the songs were. So I just mentioned Todd's name, started talking about the music. And so me and Search started building, and he liked the beats I was playing them that I had made. And we just kicked it, you know, we hit it off really good. So he invited me to come to a couple shows local while he was still on the tour. And then next thing you know, I was moving up to New York to stay with him and produce and DJ for him. And we did that for a couple of years until he kind of put the mic down temporarily and decided that he wanted to do, you know, play the businessman. So he actually was offered a job at Wild Pitch Records as VP. So he took the job And then what he did was he had set up a meeting for me to meet with Stu Fine to fill the retail position, since I had a retail background from working at the record stores. And so that's what I did. I went in there, I met Stu Fine a couple of times for a couple of interviews, and we hit it off, and I was hired. And so that's how I got to Wild Pitch from DJing.
So when you're at Wild Pitch, I mean, you read your bio, right? And it goes, you saw releases from Gangstar, OC, Main Stores, Lord Finesse, Ultra Magnet MCs, Chill Rob G, mm-hmm. and much more. Do you remember, like, the first record you heard while being there that kind of just completely blew you away, and then kind of maybe took what you thought rap music was to, like, a whole another level?
It would have to be, you know, the OC record, you know, because everything prior was already out. You know, most of those acts you just mentioned were already out before we even got there. So when we got there, the Main Source album without Lodge Professor with Mikey D was what they had just put out. So that was out, and we were working that. And they had an Entice project that they were working on, but there really wasn't much else they had ready to go. And so what Search did when he came in was try to bring in a whole bunch of new talent. And OC was one of the artists that he brought in immediately. And we had a bunch more that we had kind of like in demo deals that we were working with to see if they were going to make something that was going to be, you know, quote unquote, good enough for the label. So OC, you know, we were there for, you know, we would go to the sessions and hear the music and hear how it was coming along. And like, you know, and we knew that album was dope. I mean, there was joints on there that we, you know, really liked. And so I don't know if I'd say we knew it was going to be a classic album or it was going to change anything, but just the fact that we knew it was quality music, that was something definitely we were proud to have been part of while we were at Wild Pitch.
So there's a chance I'll probably be all over the place with my timeline, mm-hmm. But I want to go to 97.
Okay.
1997.
Yep.
Crazy Legs mm-hmm. invited you to join the Rocksteady crew.
Correct.
When he did that, what did that mean to you personally? But for listeners, what's the importance of the Rocksteady crew in terms of this overall hip hop culture?
Right. Well, I mean, it's one and the same kind of an answer. You know, growing up, again, like loving hip hop, obviously you research and find out who's who, you know, and it's like, and the cream of the crop of all the groups, you know, you had like Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five, who were like the kings of, you know, making records, you know, in that early 80s era. And then when you turn on the TV or movies to see who's representing breaking, you know, b-boying, it was the Rocksteady crew, you know what I'm saying? They were the ones that you saw more than anyone else outside of New York. Keep in mind, I was in Rhode Island, so they were the ones that transcended out of New York. So for me, Rocksteady crew always meant the epitome of b-boy crews. You know, they were top of their game. So fast forward to 97, you know, I had met Legs at some point in the 90s, and you know, I always would go to the Rocksteady anniversaries, and so we just kind of became cool. And so he had started inviting me to DJ at a bunch of the parties he would throw called Breakbeats. So I would be one of the DJs on a lot of the events, and then just from doing that for a year or two, whatever, he just one day pulled me to the side and was like, you know, would you be down to join Rocksteady crew? And it was like I had two feelings. One was like, that's incredible. But then the other feeling was like, and I told him this, I was like, well, I'd love to, but, you know, I have Nonfiction. I have this group I'm with. I constantly DJ with them. I'm on the road a lot. So I just don't know what you expect from me in terms of like, you know, being there, because I have other obligations. And he's like, nah, he's like, as long as it's not like another b-boy crew, he's like, you're good. I'm like, psh. I was like, count me in, man. I'm down. So it's like, you know, that's what it meant to me then, was to be part of an organization that to me represented the best b-boys, you know, b-girls in the world. Moving from that point forward, what Rocksteady crew means on a much bigger scale is it's not just about them being the best crew. It's about them also upholding hip hop culture, and not even just culture, but community. You know, it's like, if you look at what Crazy Legs does from a day-to-day basis, like you'll see him online posting about, you know, like right now he's talking about, you know, Puerto Rico and like what he can do to raise funds to help out Puerto Rico. And he goes down there and he's trying to bring like water filters and he's trying to get money down there and he's trying to do all these things. That's what Rocksteady is about. And he started this new organization called Rocksteady for Life, you know, and that's what it's all about. It's all about, you know, being positive with what we love. And so we take the culture, we take the music, and we take our roles or our status and use it to benefit other people. Now, within the culture, you know, we do the Rocksteady anniversaries every year. It's a free event for people to come out to, and we make sure that we lace the lineup with old school, new school, mid school, you know what I'm saying? We have DJs, MCs, depending on where the venue is, we'll do like B-boy events, and then we try to do like some live graph stuff as well. So we try to incorporate all the elements, but it's just about letting people know, like, it's a culture. It's not just about what you hear on commercial radio. You know, there is, it's a family vibe. This is all, we were all raised on hip hop, you know, so we want people to know that there is still good stuff out there and there is still meaning to what we look at as being important, you know. So that's what the Rocksteady Crew is. It's not just a B-boy organization. It's a hip hop organization that supports the culture.
You've done many ways to try to like show what's still out there, what's good out there.
Right.
You've done radio, mm-hmm. you're doing Sirius now, but you also did the halftime show, right?
Right.
So in 2000, when I was in junior in college, I started my own radio show because I heard Black Star's album and I was like, I gotta play this for the masses, but you know, whatever.
Right.
And then that got me into like listening to quote unquote underground hip hop and
right.
you know, like a lot of going to undergroundhiphop.com to see what's, you know.
Sure.
When you started your show, mm-hmm. why did you start it personally and being in a New York market?
One of the main reasons I even became a DJ, period, was actually to expose music. I enjoyed exposing music to my friends. I enjoyed putting them up on stuff they weren't familiar with. So that was what really turned me on to becoming a DJ. So while I was a DJ, when I worked at the record store, it was always about turning people on to new artists that they didn't know. That continued on throughout being a DJ. I never really wanted to be the jukebox DJ that just played whatever everyone wanted to hear. I wanted to feed them what I thought they needed to hear. And so that's been my taste the whole time I've been alive is that. And so radio to me is the perfect opportunity to do that and to play what I feel is missing or needs to have light shed on it. And so I started doing some radio when I was still in South Carolina, like 89. I was doing like a mix show on the commercial station down there for a little bit. And then when I came to New York, you know, I'd always hang out with DJ Riz up on BAU in Long Island when he was doing his radio show with Wild Man Steve. And then got cool with Stretch Armstrong. So I started hanging out up there on their show on KCR and then became cool enough with Stretch that whenever he started getting real busy doing club gigs and out of town stuff, he'd ask me to fill in for him. So I started filling in for Stretch on the KCR show. And I did that, you know, throughout the whole time that they had the show from like, I was probably on the show from maybe like 94, 95 up until like, you know, 98 or something like that. So during that time, it's like I started making a name for myself in New York by playing on that show. And so then what happened was an opportunity came up, you know, for me and Riz to get a slot on NYU. And so we took it and we went and we started doing that show because, again, it's like, that's kind of what we always believed in, you know, is that a mix show and us as DJs, it's our responsibility to play good music that we feel is good music to let people know what's out there. And so that's always been what it's about, is exposing, you know, new music to people.
Back then, what were the programming decisions like in terms of, you're in the New York market, mm-hmm. so it's a pretty big market and pretty competitive market as well, right?
Right.
So when you're up against like the Hot 97s, mm-hmm. And you're not playing the commercial stuff, right? Was there at all ever pressure for you guys to?
Never, because we were never in that type of environment. You know, everything, we were always college radio, and college radio was always anti-commercial. I mean, most of these college stations, they specifically don't want you playing anything that commercial radio would touch. So it's always been an anything goes format, you know. On everything I've done. Now that I'm on Sirius XM, this is probably the biggest platform I've been on where you would think something like that might take effect, but it doesn't. You know, and even for here, it's like they specifically have shows like mine or have shows like DJ Premier's to balance out what they do during the rest of the week and during the rest of the day. So it's like they want me and Preem to play alternative hip hop compared to what they have to play during the day. And so we don't have any handcuffs on us at all. It's just like, go, you know, do you, you know what I'm saying? They don't approve our guests. They don't approve our playlist. It's just kind of like, as long as we run a good show, they're happy. So
the halftime show was on air for 18 years.
Yes.
Were there any, like, I mean, off the top of your head, many moments that you were like, your wow moments where you're like, I can't believe we either one debuted that artist, look at where they are now, or did that on air?
Yeah. I mean, it's a bunch of stuff. I mean, it's for me, I think my highlight moments are always the anniversary shows we did, because we made those like a big party. And so we would, you know, it kind of grew from first. It was just like, I think me and Riz maybe playing some instrumentals and then inviting up a bunch of MCs, which then grew to like, okay, let's forget about us playing records. Let's actually bring up producers to bring up their drum machines and samplers and actually make beats, and then have more MCs. And then it became, let's get more producers. So then we ended up having anniversaries that had sometimes between 3 to 4 different producers, and we'd have like 30 to 40 MCs come through. And it was like, you know, we always try to get like the who's who of hip hop. So you never knew who was actually going to show up or not. And it was just, you know, everyone just rhyming. And then to me, beats, it all comes down to beats and rhymes. Forget the branding, forget the marketing, forget what you look like, what your video's like, how many records you sold. It's about, can you spit and how dope are the beats? And so that's what our anniversaries were about. And so we always just had, you know, the most fun doing those, because it was like you just sit back and hear like dope beat after beat and dope rhyme after rhyme. And being part of those was definitely my highlights over the years. But as far as like watching people that came through that blew up, I mean, you know, Eminem, you know, was someone that we had on when he was like just signing to Aftermath to Dre. Then you had Kanye, who actually wasn't even a guest that we invited. We had invited Rhymefest up, and Rhymefest brought Kanye with him. And I remember Kanye being mad cocky and was just like, you know, talking, you know, saying, yeah, I just produced this joint for Jay-Z and this, that, and the third. So it's like, you know, just going back and listening to some of these shows and hearing like, you know, how they were then and where they are now, kind of a thing. 50 Cent was another one that came through when he was like way before he did his Dre deal. So it was good seeing, you know, all these people when they were in their infancy, so to speak, you know. But we also, you know, our show started in 98. So our era was after the Stretch and Bob era, you know, which theirs ended in 98, you know what I'm saying? So it's like, you know, when you watch their documentary, like they were in the era where they had the Nas's and the Wu-Tangs and, you know, and Jay-Z's and Big L's. And we came after that. So it's like we had the Kanye's, the, you know, the M's, the 50 Cent's. We had like the next generation kind of acts to come through. As well as we still had those same type people coming through, but those are the ones that came through during our era that went on to be, you know, bigger stars.
Earlier you mentioned nonfiction. Mm-hmm. 1995, Nonfiction is formed.
Yep.
You read your bio on allmusic.com. It says, I'll paraphrase, but Eclipse eventually moved over to manage or work at Fat Beat Records. Mm-hmm. For someone who looks at the outside perspective, a fan, a kid who reads that, right? They would say, well, why would someone who's with a hip hop group move over to work at Fat Beats? What's the importance of Fat Beats, or mm-hmm. what's the importance of Fat Beat Record in terms of independent hip hop artists and underground hip hop artists, and also in terms of being a record store, which we don't really have anymore?
Yeah, well, there's a couple things with that. First off, I never left Nonfiction to go to Fat Beats. Actually, it was the other way around. But what happened was, when Nonfiction formed in 95, but we didn't put out our album until 2002. So we were just kind of grinding, doing the New York indie scene, you know, putting out singles. What had happened, though, was Nonfiction formed while Wild Pitch was still open. But then what happened was Wild Pitch closed the summer of 95. And so my initial thought was, all right, I'm going to go get another label job. So I'll just kind of, you know, hang out during the summer and collect this unemployment. And then, like, once that runs out, I'll go get another label job. Meanwhile, Fat Beats was a record store that had been open now for 1 year, which I was familiar with because that was my job, to be on top of retail stores. And so I was already supporting them the first year they were open by just going by and buying my music from them, stuff like that. Then once Wild Pitch closed, the store had kind of made enough noise from their hustle, and as well as Stretch and Bob shouting them out every week, that they were getting enough clientele that they were getting busier and busier. And so the owner, Joe, had asked me if I would be able to help him out on the weekends, because he was working like 7 days a week. So I was like, yeah, sure, I'll help you out on the weekends, you know, thinking again, like, this is going to be temporary and, you know, whatever. So that was it. Once I got in there, I never left. It was like I was there on the weekends, and then next thing you know, I was there during the week. And then, you know, a year into it, the business exploded where we actually opened up a new location. We moved from a small basement location to a second floor storefront on 6th Avenue. And so it became a phenomenon because Fat Beats, it had all the right elements. You know, you had people like me working there. You had people like Stretch and Bob supporting the store. And you had the store supporting the scene. So you had records that Stretch and Bob were playing that were independent that you couldn't really find. And so we made it our job to get those records and bring them into the store. So basically, Fat Beats became the hub for everything hip-hop. And that was also something that, surprisingly enough, wasn't around in New York City. You had stores that carried hip-hop, but there was no hip-hop stores. Rock and Soul carried other kind of music, dance music, house music, reggae, whatever. Plus, they sold, you know, equipment and everything else. Beat Street, same thing. It's like they carried different types of music. They sold washing machines and dryers in there. It's like there wasn't one record store that was just hip-hop. You know, so Fat Beats became the first store to be just hip-hop. And so we focused, you know, at that time it was just vinyl. So it was like we made sure we had all the dopest vinyl in there. And then we also went out to make sure we found all the independent vinyl that was out, which was only a handful of stuff at that time. As soon as Fat Beats exploded, we decided we're not going to have artists wait to get deals to get pressed to then bring them in. We're going to press the stuff ourselves. So we started Fat Beats Distribution, and we also started reaching out to artists and letting them know, hey, stop waiting for a record deal. Let's just press it up ourselves and put it out there. And so Fat Beats really got behind the movement, you know, and then you had people like Bobbito starting Fondalum Records. You had people like Stretch Armstrong starting Dolo Records. So now these guys who were in positions of power were starting their own labels. So everyone was starting a label, you know, snatching up talent and putting out good music. And so that's when the indie scene in New York really started booming, when you had Nonfiction, Arsonists, Juggernauts, Company Flow, Natural Elements. You know, you had the DJ crews like Executioners and Fifth Platoon, and, you know, then the Allies came around later. So it became a movement, you know, from everyone being into the same stuff, kind of doing everyone was kind of working separately. Fat Beats became kind of the hub to bring everyone together and say, hey, we actually have a movement here, and let's all just start doing shows together, and let's make something happen. So that's really when you started seeing, like, 96 into 97, all these groups starting to pop off in New York.
Was that the original plan of Fat Beats? Is your understanding is that Joe wanted this to happen, or was it just more of kind of a...
He wanted to be successful. I don't think outside of that he knew what it was going to turn into. He just wanted to have a dope store. And then I think it's kind of like one of those things where as you start going along and you start seeing how things are going, it's like, hey, you know, let's start a distribution company because we know good music and we know all the artists, you know. And then it's like, hey, let's see if we can do this in LA. You know, hey, let's see if we can do this in Europe. Let's see if we can do this down south. And so it just became one of those things where it was more of a trial and error thing, you know, just based on the success of what we were feeling in New York.
What do you think the closing of Fat Beats did for, I guess, the independent scene?
The closing of Fat Beats was very much a sign of how we all look at things now. When you look at, like, you know, social media, you know, everyone's social networks, how no one really physically interacts anymore. It's all, you know, sending each other texts or sending each other tweets or, you know, Facebook posts. It's like, you know, you don't even call your friends to find out how they're doing. You just read their updates on Facebook. And so that is what the closing of Fat Beats meant, is the changing of the guard to that world. You know, whereas prior it was, let's meet up at Fat Beats, you know, I'll meet you at Fat Beats after work, I'll meet you at Fat Beats after school, I'll meet you at Fat Beats, you know, blah, blah, blah. So everyone would come through Fat Beats, and it wasn't just about people coming through to buy records, it was coming to hang out, you know. And, like, we would have tons of cypher sessions that would be between the people that worked there and people that would come to hang out, you know? So it was like, it was just a hub of people mingling and wanting to be part of the scene, as well as people wanting to watch part of the scene, you know? So when it closed, it just, you know, everyone felt like, you know, they lost a relative, you know, because like they knew that no more were they going to have that location where they were going to be able to go and hang out and see and meet the people. And so again, it was just kind of a telling tale of the sign of like, you know, how technology had really taken over everything.
You mentioned 2002 when mm-hmm. Nonfiction dropped their then debut album. Yep. You also left Fat Beats to co-run Uncle Howie
yes,
Records.
Yes, correct.
With Ill Bill. Mm-hmm. When The Future Is Now is dropped, and you did mention that the reason why it took so long to do it, what was your role in the album, but also sound-wise, era-wise, how different do you think it sounded dropping in 2002 versus 95 when the group came first established?
When we came out in 95, you know, we started by doing demos, and then we started leaking vinyl singles, and then we started trying to get deals, you know, and we got deals that we ended up losing, you know, for one reason or the other, whether it was on our choice or the label's choice. So we went through a couple different transitions. So here we go from 95 to 2002. By the time 2002 came around, we then looked back at our earliest work and said, there's no way we're putting, you know, I Shot Reagan and Five Boroughs and Four W's on this album because they're so outdated at this point. So we took whatever the most recent music was, which was like, you know, like Black Helicopters and stuff that we did in like the late 90s as opposed to the mid 90s. And we said, we're going to keep this stuff, but we need to do, you know, more newer stuff. And then also, as we had money for budgets, it also allowed us to work with people that we were fans of, you know. So it allowed us to pay for a Premiere beat. It allowed us to pay for a Pete Rock beat. You know, it allowed us to pay for a few Lodge Professor beats. So it became us, you know, not just working with in-house people, but actually going out there and making the album that we wanted to make. And so most of the musical decisions was the groups in terms of like, you know, Bills, The Box and Gore-Tex's, you know, who they wanted to work with. And I even at that point, I was kind of playing the manager facilitator of like, all right, well, let me reach out to this guy and let me reach out to that guy and get the beats and stuff. And then, you know, they would take the beats, they'd listen to them, pick the ones they wanted, they'd write the rhymes to them, come up with the concepts, and then if there was something they wanted scratches on, they'd tell me, okay, we want scratches on this one. And some things I came up with the ideas for scratches, some things they told me what they wanted scratched. And so that's kind of how we put the album together. And it was just, again, like once it was done, we kind of looked at it like, you know, like, wow, like we actually, you know, ended up using a great list of producers and really made, like, you know, we were really happy with what we ended up putting out, you know. So
were you all, when the album was created, were all four of you guys in the studio together at all?
Not all the time. Usually I'd say those guys were mostly in the studio together. I was probably the least involved there because I also live the furthest away. The studio we built was basically in their neighborhood. So they were actually able to kind of get there quick and easy. I had to take like four trains to get there. So for me, it was like, I'm going when I have to go, you know, as much to go hang out. So I wasn't there as much as they were, but I was there when I needed to be.
I want to quickly jump back to 95. Mm-hmm. Nonfiction signs with Geffen Records. Mm-hmm. It seemed that reading up on you guys that you, in talking to you, you guys kind of had the choice of the letter in terms of labels to sign to, mm-hmm. but Geffen was the...
I don't know if we'd say we had the full choice like that, but there was... that was definitely the best, you know, the best option, the best deal. You know, Search was down with Nonfiction at the time, and Search was a good businessman. You know, he was definitely was, you know, he was a good promo guy. He knows how to talk a good game. So he got us a good deal from Geffen, and we took that deal. And I think the problem with that was just that I think they might have been looking for the next, you know, rendition of Third Base when, you know, we were kind of like the furthest thing from that, you know, whereas Third Base was like dope but funny, you know, we were kind of like dope but serious, you know, right. So to speak. It's like, you know, we were kind of like, we weren't political, but people used to call us that just because we talked about subjects that like were controversial and stuff like that, you know. So you know, we were a mix somewhere between like P.E., Mobb Deep, and Wu-Tang, you know, like grimy, but like with drop jewels, stuff like that. And so I think the stuff, when we, like, again, like when we made records like I Shot Reagan, and we turned it into the label, and they're like, you can't put this out. And, you know, and it's just like, no, well, we can. Of course we can, you know. So it just, it was starting to become clear that like what they want and what we wanted were two different things. And so that's why it just didn't work out with them.
Let's fast forward to today. Mm-hmm. The Halftime Show ended in 2016.
Yes.
You're currently the host of Rap Is Out of Control on Sirius XM. One, when did the show start? But also, was it something that you pitched the idea to Sirius? They came to you? How did that go about?
The Sirius show actually came about by Premiere. DJ Premiere has his show Live from Headquarters, which has been on longer than my show has been on. And I don't even know exactly when my show started. I don't know why I don't have an exact start. Well, I'll tell you why I don't have an exact start date, but with Premiere, it was a similar situation how it was with me and Stretch. Premiere hit me up like, yo, I'm going to be out of town on tour for a long period of time, and I need someone to fill in for me, and there's really no one else I can trust but you. I know what you do for Halftime. I know you're capable. You have the skills. You know the music. Would you be down to fill in? I'm like, of course. So I started filling in for him up here. And then through that, I actually met some of the people that worked up here who actually were fans of my show on NYU. And so it just became one of those things where they liked what I was doing here. They liked what I was doing at NYU. And then once they themselves had the power to actually make decisions here, they reached out to me and said, hey, would you want your own show up here? So I was like, yeah, I'll take that. And so what happened was when I actually started, I think they offered me the gig before they actually offered me the date. And so it was like, all right, you know, we're going to get you a show. And then it just took forever to finally kind of put it through. And then once they finally put it through, it was the same week I was leaving for like a 2-month tour with Nonfiction or La Cosa Nostra, whatever. I forget which group it was. So now I'm like starting a new mix show, and I'm not going to be here for 2 months. So I ended up having to like record each show while on tour. Like after one of the shows, I had my turntables and mixer with me on the tour. I'd bring the stuff into the hotel room. I'd set it up like on the bathroom sink, and then like just record, you know, a mix for like 2 hours, 3 hours. And I'd sit back and edit it all. And like the next day, as we drive to the next city for the next show, I'd be editing the show to make sure it's like exactly like a 2-hour, you know, length. And then once I had it done, I'd have to have whoever's driving pull over off the highway. We'd have to find a hotel. We'd drive into the hotel parking lot. If I could grab a Wi-Fi signal from the parking lot, I would. If I couldn't, I would then get out of the van. I'd make them wait in the van for me. I'd go in the hotel lobby, sit there, get their Wi-Fi, and upload the mix to Sirius, and then get back in the van and continue driving to the rest of the tour. So I had to do that for 2 months straight. So then I come back, and then kept doing the show. And then what happened, and I don't think, even when I came back, I think I was still pre-recorded, so I wasn't live yet. Then at some point we went live, and then what happened was the merger between Sirius and XM. And when that happened, there was a lot of personnel changes, and they brought a lot of the XM people from DC up here, and they moved stuff around. They got rid of channels, they got rid of shows, and my show got lost in the shuffle, so that my show got pulled. Then months went by. I don't remember exactly how many. It could have been 3, it could have been 6, but months went by, and then I guess they weren't happy with what changes were made, and so they ended up putting the same people back in the same position they were. They started bringing back some of the same shows and channels, and so I was offered the show again. And so from that point, I started it again, and I had been going ever since, you know. But so because of all those things, I never really know what my start date was of like when I first started the show and stuff like that. So it's like, it's everything else I've done, I can pretty much tell you the beginning and end, but this one I don't even know. So
Is Rap Is Out of Control, do you feel it's a similar show to the Halftime?
Yeah, Rap Is Out of Control is pretty much a continuation of what we do on Halftime. Difference is that instead of a 2.5-hour show, it's 2 hours. Instead of having to play clean music, it's dirty versions. And the only thing because I had the two shows, what I would do differently was, even though the music might have been very similar, I kind of started making Halftime a little bit more of the incubator and Rap Is Out of Control more of the main stage. And so because of the fact that, you know, we're on Hip Hop Nation and the next channel over is Shade 45, you know, which is Eminem's channel. So it's like, you know, that means at that time it meant like, you know, 50 Cent in the game and like all these major big artists. And so I didn't want to just be playing like the most obscure name. I was like, I wanted to play the best of what was out there, both indie, but also major label stuff. So I kind of looked at the Sirius show as being more of like, okay, like you want to come up to this show, then you actually have to have done something. It can't be just like, oh, hey, I'm an MC, let me come up. Whereas with Halftime, I'd kind of let you do that as long as I like the music. The music's good. All right, come up to Halftime. That's going to be your starting point, you know? And then if I see you continuing to do stuff and you kind of grind it out and stop making a little bit more noise, then I'll bring you up to the Sirius show, which to me I was trying to make as like the bigger, the next step up. So now Halftime's gone, you know, I've probably stepped back a little bit from that thought and let some more people come up here that I might not have when I had Halftime still going. But again, it's just, for me, it has to be about the music. So it's like, if you're not making music I don't like, there's no reason for you to come up here.
When someone submits music to you or you hear music, mm-hmm. what are you listening for? I mean, a dope beat is, I mean, how important is content?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's like, it's about the beat has to catch me first. You know, I have to actually hear music that has my head bopping, because you always, 9 times out of 10, you hear the music before you hear the vocals.
Right.
So it's like, I have to be into the beat has to be banging, and then once the vocals start, then it's like, now I'm checking out for the sound of the voice, the delivery, you know, can the kid rhyme? If, you know, you can tell when someone's nervous and it's like, all right, they're not ready, turn them off, you know. But for me, it's first the beat and then the rhymes. The content for me, it's like, I'm not going to say it doesn't matter, but it's more about the execution of it, you know. And I say that to say this, a lot of times, you know, people preach about, you know, we need more positive music, you know, and not that we don't, but to me, Onyx, Throw Your Guns in the Air is a classic hip hop song, you know what I'm saying? But when you think about what they're talking about, like, you know, they're talking about guns, you know what I'm saying? So just because someone's talking about something negative doesn't necessarily mean that it should be shunned, you know what I'm saying? So it's all about basically the execution and delivery and how you put together the song. So I don't care, you know, if it's a song about, if it's like the making of the movie Scarface, as long as it's done dope and you know, it's creative, then I'm going to play it, you know what I'm saying? So it's not just about, and at the same time, I'm not going to play something that's positive just because it's positive if it's whack, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like if someone's like talking about God for the whole song, but like can't rhyme or can't be on beat, it's not getting played. So it's like, I'm not playing something that because it's positive or because it's negative. I'm playing something because it's actually a well put together song.
You obviously hear a ton of music every week, every day. And then sometimes I feel like, okay, so for example, when I, speaking of positive hip hop, when I went on my Black Star kick.
Yes.
So I remember in fifth grade, I played Self-Destruction as a song to present to my class.
Okay.
I can't tell you what I was presenting exactly, but, and then I went and I played a lot, and then like sixth grade, I was listening to a lot of Public Enemy, and then I went through a phase of just like, it was commercial, it was on the radio, it must be whack, or they sold out, whatever.
Right.
And in hindsight, you listen to, like, Big Pun was incredible. You know, in hindsight, right. So I felt like I lost a lot. Like, I talked to a friend, I lost a lot of actually, like, what was really good music.
Gotcha.
Super back then. Do you ever feel that because you're listening to so much music and, you know, your mind is set on your show, that you're not seeing as much, or you're not hearing as much good music as you possibly could?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'll give you an example of not the exact same thing that you're saying, but similar is the fact that, I just did actually, a DJ set on Funkmaster Flex's, 5 Minutes of Funk episode that he does. And I played, the OC Big L Dangerous record that the Beat Miners produced, and I said it at the end of the set. I was like, I did not like that record when it first came out, and I told Mr. Walt that, you know, who produced it, because he had sampled Daisy Lady, and at the time that in that era of like 97, I was looking for like the next create. I wanted to hear the next creative loop that I hadn't heard before, and so when I heard Daisy Lady, I'm like, oh, I'm like, come on, how are you going to use Daisy Lady? Like, it's been used so many times. Like, you know, no. And so just because of that fact, it made me shun away from that song, where in hindsight, that song was incredible. Like, it was a great, it was a dope use of Daisy Lady on that song with dope drums, and OC and Big L killed it. Like, the way they delivered this, the flow on it was like just a classic song. And so it took me, I don't know how long it took me to get over that, but it took me some time to kind of look past the fact that it was Daisy Lady and open up my mind and be like, you know, that's just a dope song regardless. And so sometimes, yeah, you definitely have to like kind of step out of your box to be like, you know what, like, it's more than just that. It's, you gotta really appreciate it for what it is. And so there's not many other examples like that, but there's definitely been a few things where it's like, because of whatever reason, I kind of like overlooked it. But I always try to give, for the most part, like an open ear to everything, you know, but also being aware of my platform. And so if I hear something that's like blatantly commercial, but I like it, I might like it and not play it, you know, here. You know, I might play it like, you know, at a club or something like that. You also have to know where you're at different times and know like what you're playing is meant for a particular audience. You know what I'm saying? So that's important.
Do you have a go-to record or records that you kind of like just play for yourself to kind of, I guess, maybe reset your ears or reset your camp?
I don't particularly have a record like that to go to, but like I'm constantly listening to mixes at home. You know, like when I'm cleaning, when I'm, you know, doing dishes, whatever, anything I'm doing at home, I'll throw on a mix, whether it's mostly mine because I like to like kind of analyze what I've done in the past, but it could be one of Riz's or, you know, where was in my iPhone at the moment. Like, I always keep it full of mixes, and I just like, I'm always studying and I'm always analyzing. And so that to me is like refreshing, you know, just to kind of like listen to something. I might listen to last week's show, you know, but then I might go back and listen to something I did like 10 years ago, you know, and I like to listen to a lot of throwback mixes I do of like 80s music and stuff like that, because to me, that, I guess that would be the biggest reset for me, is like listening to 80s hip hop, you know what I'm saying? Because that to me is like the pinnacle of kind of when it was like, I don't know, something like refreshing about the 80s, late 80s hip hop, when in that golden era where it was just like everything was kind of blossoming and like you had all these crazy new groups coming out and styles coming out. And so that was like my childhood era, so to speak. So I always kind of go back to that, those mixes, to like really get that reset before I kind of, like, I guess, go back in something else.
I just want to go talk about influences. Mm-hmm. We're at a point where rap is the most popular genre
right
out there. So, and you have kids who are growing up listening to rap, mm-hmm, versus growing up listening to like, God, right, you know, rock,
Casey Kasem.
from a sound perspective, and from beats, how do you think the beat creation has changed with, let's say, the older generation versus this generation who is creating hip hop music, but their influence is hip hop music? What are you hearing?
Well, it's kind of a two part question or answer here, because my analogy first on the progression of hip hop music is this. Like, when you look at, you know, hip hop that was being done in the park, it was being done over breakbeats. You know, the DJs were cutting up breaks. So when it became time to make records, no one really knew how to make a beat. It was more of like, let's rhyme over that break. And so legally you can't do that. So then you had bands, the Sugar Hill Band, you had Pumpkin, you had these musicians that were replaying the breaks. So all that old Enjoy and like Sugar Hill, you know, was like basically like live instrumentation, a lot of it just replaying breaks and popular music. So that was like the first era. Then you got into like the drum machines, the Linn drums and, you know, and SP, Roland 808s, 909s. So you had that era of like just drum programming, you know, the Larry Smith, Run DMC stuff, you know, Houdini stuff, and then like Mantronics and all that stuff. So you had all these drum programmings, Davey D. And then you had Molly, and you had sampling, and you had the late 80s. And when sampling came around, it took it a step further. So now it's getting better and better and better. Now, after the late 80s into the early 90s, now you have like the next set of producers. You have your Premieres, your Pete Rocks, your Lodge Professors. you have these guys that are not necessarily just like looping the way Marley was looping and putting stuff together. Now they're actually like chopping, you know, and they're filtering, and they're actually changing the loop, the samples that they're taking and moving them around. And so it, to me, it's always progressed and progressed and progressed, and up until, let's say, like the mid-90s, you know. Then after that point of the mid-90s, it went back to like the whole kind of like commercial era. And I'll use Puffy as the best example because he was probably the biggest at the time, of someone that was like just straight up looping the most popular records he can find, you know, whether it was Diana Ross or, you know, The Police, Missing You. And like, he was just basically going for like the biggest impact you can make as opposed to like the most creative record he can make. And so that was kind of like starting to see the downfall of the creativity of hip hop, in my opinion. And then it started going, you know, down. And then you started having other regions step up and making important music, like, you know, the South, like Atlanta was became huge for hip hop. And they became so huge that New York started taking a back seat to that. And so then New York artists then start thinking, well, wait, maybe we should make music like that. And so like then they start making music like that. Now years go by, and now the whole, there's no, you're starting to lose the identity of New York, and you're starting to like now New York sounding like Atlanta, you know. So now what that's doing is decades are going by. So now the younger generation who's coming up is listening to these artists. And so you have artists, let's say like an ASAP Rocky that, or French Montana even, that like are from New York, but their music doesn't necessarily sound like New York music. You know, it just sounds more like, you know, some people might say it sounds more Southern. It's got like that kind of a trap sound to it. So now it's just like, so people growing up, even in New York, it's like they're hearing now what they feel is current hip hop, and it's that style of music, you know? So, and it's just so far back to me from where it's gone already, you know what I'm saying? So it's like, to me, the pinnacle kind of reached its peak in the mid-90s, both for lyricism and for beats, you know? And now it's like, outside of a few, you know, most of the stuff that you hear on commercial radio is just really watered down gibberish, you know? It's like the MCs aren't saying anything. It's all basically like strip club music. And the beats are just like, they might bump in your car, but it's like, there's no, it just doesn't speak to me. You know what I'm saying? It's like, so now, you know, I just stick with my lane, which is the independent underground scene, because to me, that's the continuation of where it left off in the mid 90s. The people in the indie scene are the ones that are carrying the torch to me for hip hop. The ones that are actually still caring about the lyrics they write, the ones that are still caring about the music they select, and like, and how it's being put together, and you know, making beats and stuff like that. So it's, you know, for those that are just coming up now in this era, if you're only listening to commercial radio, it's like you're really getting just one angle, one dimension of kind of like what hip hop has to offer you.
Do you think that's going to break? I mean, do you think there's going to be a point where they kind of just, I mean, because it seems like those guys, I mean, you talk to enough people and it just seems like the independent scene means longevity. Right. I mean, in terms of the artists, right, versus like the commercial scene with what you're talking, they're just one hit wonders.
Right.
I mean, do you think we'll get to the point where it would just, that will break and
you know
come
what?
Back?
It's hard to say. That's the one thing about hip hop is that it's always been about what's new, what's next. You know, hip hop has never been fond of what's already been here. Everyone wants hip hop for itself. You know, back when it was like the you know, taping off of Red Alert or Marley or even the Stretch and Bob era, everyone wanted to have the joint for themselves. They didn't want anyone else to have it. They wanted to be the only one with it. They wanted to feel special. And that's always what hip hop has been about, is about feeling special. And so that's the downfall, the downside of hip hop, is that we don't really respect what came before us. And so everyone's just looking for what's next, what's next. You know, they see, you know, videos from like Master P and them, and to me, that's why I think they became so big in New York, was not because of the music, but because of how they were branded. When you look at the videos, you saw the money, you saw the cars, we didn't have that. You know, there wasn't New York artists that were popping like that. So it was like people are checking these guys out, like, yo, like, who are these guys and why are they popping? You know, so people want to be down with something that they feel is bigger than they are or better than they are. So it became that thing where it's just like everyone kind of like wanted to be down with and affiliated with what was popping. So with that, it's like, you know, the independent scene, yeah, there's a longer road maybe, but the flip side to that is that it's a cheap road, you know. So it's like not many can survive that long road, especially coming out nowadays, because, you know, when we came out with Nonfiction, it was the 90s when there was you know, kind of pre-internet or just starting. So, you know, you still had to kind of like be somewhere. You still had to go and do the open mics. You still had to become, you had to be a presence on the scene. Whereas now it's like, you really don't have to go anywhere. You can just become a phenomenon by putting out a YouTube video, you know, and just getting going viral. So the avenues are different now for people to succeed. And so, yes, there's a lot of one hit wonders, you know, on the radio that you're not going to remember 5 years from now, but you know, they might make enough money in that 1 or 2 years to live for quite a while off the money they make, you know, doing the shows and whatever spins they're getting, you know. But that's another thing too, is just like, you know, when you think about classic songs and music, you know, I always say to people, because I don't know a lot of these mainstream artists' music, what their hits are, you know. It's like, what are their hits? It's like they seem to be popular, but a lot of them don't seem to have hits. They just seem to be popular because they just know how they can relate to the crowd. The kids can relate to them. But, like, I don't hear their music at games, sports games. I don't hear their music. I still hear, you know, House of Pain, Jump Around. I still hear Naughty by Nature, Hip Hop Hooray. It's like, those are classics. Those are songs that, like, are going to stand the test of time and are, like, cemented in every fabric of our lives. You turn on the TV and it's in commercials. It's in, you know, and it's just like, I don't see a lot of this music that's happening now translating to further than where it is right now. You know, I don't see it being anthems at ball games. I don't see it being, you know, licensed for like an Apple product commercial. You know, it's just like, it kind of seems like it's here for the moment. It's good club music and that's kind of it. So
do you think, and I believe probably the answer is no. I believe the answer is no. But do you think hip hop culture is in danger, or better yet, do you think maybe the rap element?
Yeah, sure. Well, I don't say it's in danger. I mean, again, because there's more than enough hip hop artists out there. Hip hop culture has never been in danger, and I don't believe ever will be, because there's enough of us here that know the difference between the culture and the music. You know what I'm saying? That's something. I actually had a debate with somebody not too long ago who was trying to say how Cardi B was good for hip hop culture. And I'm like, no. I was like, you know, he's trying to say, like, because she, you know, was number one on Billboard and this, that, and the third, like, that's good for hip hop. I'm like, that's debatable. I was like, but definitely not good for hip hop culture. I was like, there's a, you know, and he's like, oh, what? Like, she raps, doesn't she? That's hip hop culture. I was like, no, it's not. There's two totally different things. And that's not an opinion. That's a fact. Rapping is an element of hip hop culture. But just because you rap does not mean you are part of hip hop culture. It just means you're a rapper. If Justin Bieber wants to start rapping, doesn't mean he's part of hip hop culture. It just means he's rapping. You know what I'm saying? It's like same thing with DJing. It's like there's DJs that don't play hip hop, that play like house music or EDM. Just because you're a DJ doesn't mean you're automatically part of hip hop culture. It's about what you do that makes you part of the culture. And so for those that you can tell that care about their craft and care about the events they do and stuff like that, then those are the ones that you can say, yes, like he is definitely part of hip hop culture. Like this guy is, you know, is down. And then the ones that are like just here to kind of like make a hit and then like, you know, kind of disappear next week, you know, those guys are just rappers.
Last question. Mm-hmm. You look at all the elements of hip hop. You could say rap music. Rap is the element that represents it now.
Right.
You're a DJ, but you're obviously well-versed and passionate for hip hop. If you were to pick one element to be the quote unquote commercial representative of hip hop, would it be?
I mean, it would have to be rap, just because, you know, it's the most successful, you know, out of all the elements. You know, it's like graph doesn't get its really just, you know, deserves. It's like there's not as many popular graph writers that are going mainstream, you know, work. You know, DJs, kind of same thing. It's like everyone plays the backseat to a rapper. You know, rapper is by far the most important in-your-face element of hip-hop, you know, culture is the rapper. That's the one that gets the most shine. That's the one that's on, you know, the videos. That's the one that's on the talk shows. That's the one that's on the award shows. It's like, it's the rapper, you know what I'm saying? So it's like that would have to be the representation if you had to narrow it down to one.
He's a member of the Rock City Crew. He's a radio host at SiriusXM. He's a manager. It was a great and honor to talk to him. It's DJ Eclipse. Thank you so much for joining me on the live here with Tim Reinicke.
Yeah, thank you, Tim.
Thank you so much,
yes,
man.
Yes, sir. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's a rumble, and money got crushed in the rubble for faking the funk inside the concrete jungle. DJ Clips on the cut with Bill with him. Suck MC, well, you can go to hell with him. Well, this is a warhead, it's Vietnam here. The 5% nation, the brothers of the law here. Whether he good or not, his office are put a pop. He ain't alive, but he got cut in the butcher shop. You can't touch the mic, you don't deserve to. If he didn't learn to, then he getting burned too. The kings and queens are rebuilding they throne. With hardcore drums, it's the tail of Jay's own. Suckers are pet. So they better let go, cause I'm the human lightning bolt like Electro. Y'all ain't stepping up, cause y'all ain't deaf enough. Yo, DJ Clips, just cut the record up.
We on a different level. You know I slam. I'm in a clip, ready to flip. What's a mad jam? Check it out. It's hardcore.
You're laid in the dirt and got put into a hearse. Suckers try to battle, but they get their heads burst. And y'all couldn't move me, I cut them like sushi. The word is a gun and it'll spray like a ooze. I'm built with the guards until knowledge is born on them. It took a little while for the science to dawn on them. You fade like a barber, my blade was just sharper. The son that was born was the same as the father. None of y'all could come before me or come after me. You fucking with past and it could be a catastrophe. Knowledge is infinite, you couldn't live with it. Suckers will fade and get played like an instrument. Nothing can harm me, why try bomb me? You couldn't fuck around with past with the army. 32 bars of death will shut them up. DJ Clips on the wheel, so cut it up.
Gonna rock it, Billy Bash.